right, so now on to our second talk. I'd like to introduce Dr. Peter Sherman, who will be speaking on Christian Professors Without Borders, Doing Justice Where Brain Drain Depletes the Common Good.
Thank you. My name is Peter Sherman, and I've actually published in the area of the megachurch phenomenon and the leadership charisma, and more recently studying clergy sexual abuse and faith deconstruction, and mostly from a sociological and theological perspective. And my methodology is really ethnography, with a past as a university campus minister. So the topic today of brain drain is not really my field. It's economics, politics, international studies, and maybe a little bit of missiology. But I work in this field, so I figure I'm going to do some preliminary research and see where it takes me. All right, you may have heard in the church service this morning, I'm the executive director of Global Scholars Canada for 5 years now, a charity that sends and equips Christian professors to do cross-cultural and transnational work inspired by their Christian faith to underserviced areas of the globe. We work with an American partner of the same name and with the International Christian Faculty Guild called the Society of Christian Scholars. We believe that as the university goes, so go the students, and soon, so goes the culture. And so equipping Christian professors to be a redemptive influence in their classrooms and research is a key strategy for advancing the gospel and fostering international collaboration. So I want to talk about brain drain today and brain gain, and how it might be understood and addressed by Christian networks that are concerned about faith, justice, international development, and science. So I just wanted to say I recognize there's some scholars in the room who may have migrated from a developed country, and I acknowledge there's many reasons for leaving home, including personal safety, family obligations, political unrest, and this is not a judgment on anyone's personal story, but I wanted to have a conversation about some global trends and talk about global justice. The term brain drain is used as a synonym for the movement of human capital, the net flow of expertise being in one direction. The use of brain means any skill, competency, science, or attribute that's a potential asset. The use of drain implies that this rate of exit is at a greater level than normal or what might be desired. And linking the two implies the departure of the most talented at an appreciable rate. This is a justice issue because you can see how this easily becomes a vicious circle. Talent leaves, development slows. Because development slows, talent leaves. It's more complicated than that. I'm going to talk about some of that complication. But this is the general problem when we use the word brain drain. So here's the big picture at a glance. Fund for Peace is an American nonprofit, a non-governmental research and educational institution that came up with this index. And I don't really understand how they got the scores, but they combined quantitative factors with qualitative factors like political and climate events and came up with this index. So you can see Canada is at 0.8 and Somalia at the bottom is at 8.7. And Sierra Leone, 7.3. So there's a lot of disparity here, pretty significant disparity. And then here is another map that I got from Fund for Peace, which shows Africa as the continent with the highest index scores. And that's really my focus for the most part today, Africa. And I found Stats Canada 2021 said among all international students in Canada, 40% with a bachelor degree stay, 36% of graduate students with a doctoral degree stay, and 58% of those with a college diploma stay. And some of you may know from Canada, we have a point system in terms of immigration, that you can't come in the country unless you stack up enough points in terms of your education experience, etc. So we're filtering very deliberately. Now, that said, arriving as a highly skilled immigrant in the new host country like Canada is not always the dream that you may have imagined. Peter Lee studied highly skilled Chinese immigrants to Canada and concluded this It's difficult to speculate why Chinese-born immigrants with a university degree keep coming to Canada. Why? Well, the overwhelming evidence indicates their degree is likely to be discounted. And I think that's for some professions and ethnicities more than others. Still, overall, there are winners and losers. And this article seemed to say that overall, when brains migrate, everybody benefits on the whole as an aggregate. But still, there's losers and there's winners. And Africa is always the loser. So what do we do with this data? I think it's a distribution problem and thus a justice issue that Christians should be concerned about. We have an ambiguous legacy on this planet, especially with regards to colonialism. But we also have a tremendous concern for justice that's born out of our story. And that's about the image of God and the dignity and worth that human beings have, and about special concern for the poor. You'll recall Jesus saying, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me and has anointed me to proclaim good news for the poor." Ethical responsibility to mitigate the unfair trends of talent migration, which exacerbate problems in developing countries by decreasing their population of skilled human capital, or drawing out their brightest and best, is something that governments, businesses, educational institutions, the ASA, and mission organizations have some ethical obligation to think about and do something about. There's a Canadian social justice worker, Gerald Van de Zande, who died a little while ago. He had a book called Justice, Not Just Us. And that's a handy way to think about justice. Or someone else said, justice is love put into social structures. It's kind of a handy way to think about it. But there are push factors, there are pull factors that all contribute to brain drain. And that includes government policies, poor working conditions, low salaries, political instability, et cetera, et cetera. I picked out three perspectives that try to give a frame to understand brain drain. The neo-Marxist approach puts the blame on here in the inherent structures of global capitalism, which perpetuates economic inequalities by exploiting the labor and dreams of the poor. State policies are key in this perspective, but it's focused on the thing as an environmental, economic problem. The post-colonial frame sees brain drain as the legacy of colonialism and as a cultural issue, first and foremost, as global inequalities are perpetuated through the cultural power dynamics and the cycle of dependency that is the legacy of colonialism. And then finally, network analysis approach. This is very interesting. They see migration of skilled labor as an opportunity for knowledge circulation and transfer, as well as the remittances to the family that go back home through the diaspora. So this is like a positive view of brain drain. There's ambiguities to this whole notion here. And I'm going to say the general trend of brain drain is still there from poor countries to richer countries. But these remittances, there's a graph I lifted off the World Bank that shows the amount of remittances that go from the diaspora to the home country. It's phenomenal. They say it's more than international aid, which is phenomenal, right? So there's lots to think about here. It's a multifaceted phenomenon. Now, I want to address some ways to address this inequity and talk about what's been called brain gain. The network scientists, actually, the network theory people, like to talk about brain circulation, which to me kind of obfuscates the inequalities. But it does make the point that there's a lot of stuff going on this planet in terms of where brains are going and how it's all working. Now, before I talk about structural practices, I'd like to mention what I'm calling the religious motivation strategy. Because I do think a religious orientation, particularly that of the skilled workers and graduate students, is important. My theory is quite simply that those with a worldview and practice that nurtures altruism will be more likely to mitigate the worst of brain drain as opposed to those who hold to more selfish, competitive, or let's say upward mobility-focused narratives in their life. And I don't think Christianity is the only altruistic worldview, but I do think it's a radically compelling one. Consider what our scholar and global scholars, Dr. Manhee Yun, said when asked about what he tells his Christian students at the University of the Gambia with regards to their vocation. And you can read it there, but he says, Jesus came down to earth, and that's been the salvation of the world. So I teach my students that they shouldn't go to places they want to go, but go to the places where they're needed. We Christians do everything for the glory of God, which means serving others. So we equip ourselves academically, but we use our knowledge and training for the purpose of serving others. If there are more needs in the home country, then you got to come back. But if there's enough human resources in the home country, then you should go to another place where there's a greater need of service. And this is words spoken by a man who was raised in Korea, trained in the U.S. and then Canada, and then, I don't have time to tell the whole story, but apparently he was a friend who was defending his PhD. Afterwards, they were gathered at a coffee shop. One of the professors who's linked with us said, oh, we really need a New Testament scholar to go to the Gambia. It was the Old Testament. And he said he felt the Lord stir within his heart. And he said right there, I'll go. And I said to him, did you know where the Gambia was? He goes, no, I knew it was in Africa somewhere. I said, did you know the poverty? And he said, I didn't know anything about that. I said, did your wife know about this? He said, she had agreed when we were married that we would go where the Lord calls. So that's the man who's talking here. And he's still in the Gambia 6 years later. At the core of the Christian story is a God who came to serve at great cost to himself. And I think the narratives that we live inside are not deterministic, but they shape the decisions we make for our lives. And I don't think the default consumerist worldview or a naturalistic worldview can compel such altruism in the same way. Narratives matter. Brains are led by hearts, and hearts can love money, they can love fame, they can love service, and a good, hard challenge that makes a difference in the world. All right, there's other strategies that are talked about in the literature, which I'd like to illustrate with examples from our agency, and those are the three I'm going to go through fairly quickly. First of all, strengthen African educational institutions by providing better opportunities and incentives to stay. Now, we do this with the Christian Studies Center at the University of Gambia, which we kind of set up, and that's where Dr. Manhee Yun is. We provide the professors, we sponsor students with scholarships, and we're now proposing a master's degree to the university in addition to our bachelor program. So we provide full tuition for eligible candidates. We've graduated 70 students there since 2016. And if you think about the amount of money that it costs to take one scholar from Africa, bring them to Canada or the U.S., train them there, house them and their family, and hope they go back, which is not always the case, this is a great deal. This is a great deal, and it's making a big difference. Secondly, develop information exchange and collaboration between African institutions and international organizations. This way they can stay in their home country and simultaneously have access to quality research and ideas. And this is what our partner organization, the Society of Christian Scholars, does, which is currently led by the Nigerian Dr. Osam Temple. They are a web portal that connects 400 Christians worldwide who are members, and then about 600 others who come to the conferences and such. They set up mentorships, editing opportunities, networking for the conferences, access to research databases, and a curriculum to develop how your faith and your scholarship work together. So there's modules there you could go through. Another story is Dia Diafwala, a refugee from the Congo who came to Canada, escaping for his life at the time, and did a University of Ottawa PhD in psychology. And then through us, he's been teaching in the Cameroon and back in the Congo online from Canada. So we're increasing the network of knowledge sharing and collaboration from Canada to Africa. 5 minutes. All right. Thirdly, we use grants to stimulate African networks of academic research and build capacity and academic reputations in regional centers within Africa. So Dr. Stephen Ney lives in Sierra Leone, and he partners with us and the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students and the Templeton Fund, and he's running something called the Logos and Cosmos Initiative that is mentoring, I forget how many Francophone African students in the realm of faith and science. Current projects that they get mentoring on include such things as anti-erosion, food security, climate change, biblical perspectives on ecology, communicating science, interesting enough, given our last talk, and human genome editing. So this is a great way to have them stay in Africa, but still access some of the best grant funding agencies of the planet and get mentoring in it. So, in conclusion, development is linked to leadership and innovation, which is linked to science and education and skills and resources, which are dependent on individual and collective motivation, which is inspired and reinforced by the narratives and practices that arrive from the communities in which we live and belong. So, I'll stop there so we have a little more time for questions.
Thank you very much for a very engaging talk, very informative, and I'm sure we've all learned a lot. With that, I'd like to open up the floor to questions.
Thank you for your talk. My question is, if you wanted to implement this model in other places of the world, like working in Cambodia and parts of Southeast Asia, where do the funding sources come to begin to implement the model? Because you have support to do this model, yes?
I have to raise the money.
Okay, so yeah. You're privately raising money to do it.
Yeah, I'm knocking on doors, foundations. I mentioned the Templeton Fund for that one project. Yeah, different places. Some the scholars themselves raise some of their own funds. Some get, like in the University of Gambia, I think he gets a salary, but it's a pittance, and so he has to fundraise in order to travel home, to visit family, and the scholarships pay for the students' tuitions. And I have to raise that money.
So this is you would say then, if we wanted to implement this somewhere else, it's a visionary model, and then we would need to raise funds to implement that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Peter, for interesting presentation. There's a question about the role of English in this effort. Would you agree that especially Canadian scholars have a unique asset, and that's the English language, which is in high demand around the world? Do you think we could somehow build on this and start sending professors and offer them for partly for their ability to teach in English?
Yeah. I think it's a problem as well as an asset, because it can be limiting too, right? And was it John Patrick used to come to these conferences all the time? John Patrick's with the other one. Yeah, he would say to me, Peter, there's a lot of stupid people in Canada. They only know one language, or they only know two languages, he would say. So it's an asset, and we can leverage that, but it's also limiting. Yeah.
Thank you for your response. Any other questions from the audience?
Anyone who's migrated from one country to another want to tell a story? I know there's a number of you in the room.
Good afternoon. Now, you have mentioned that in the Gambia, you send people, they train there, and then they stay there. Is that correct?
So our professors go there.
Yes.
And they teach there. And they, the one there, one's been there 10 years, another one 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they train locals who come from Senegal and some other places too.
Correct.
And the goal is to raise up students who will at least one or two get a graduate degree and then come back and become the teachers.
The reason why a lot of African students migrate is both to acquire education and to get a job. Because in most of these cases, when they go back home, they find themselves in a situation where they don't have the jobs, or if they do, the kind of remunerations they get is just not commensurate with whatever quality they have. Also, another problem is simply political. When you come back home at a higher level of education, there is always mistrust from those that are there. They think you are bringing up something either to challenge their positions or to really introduce foreign kind of, you could say, thinking. And then you become a target unnecessarily. That is one of the reasons why people migrate to some of these countries, US, Canada, UK, and stay there. Not that they really don't want to contribute to their own countries. It's just a very difficult situation. Now, yeah. I'm saying this from experience. Yeah. I was born in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Went to Sierra Leone actually to get my education. So when you talked about the Gambia, I was there.
Yeah.
And then from there went to the UK. From the UK back to the United States. Again, all this is really a very complex situation. I know sometimes we simplify things. It's not easy.
Yeah, I hope you heard me say it's complex and multi-dimensional. And it's hard. And I know in some places, the teaching load that some of these people who stay take on is very, very difficult. And the pay is really bad. But that's why I talked about building infrastructure and helping people stay so that they can still be part of the culture and don't have to leave and then try to come back having been westernized or whatever. But it is complex. And every story, once you've heard one story about migration, you've heard one story about migration.
Do you have any experience with healthcare professionals? I know in the U.S., if we didn't have African healthcare professionals, we would have, you know, even a more severe workforce shortage. You know, so it's the training they receive in Nigeria, say, and then they just want to come to the U.S. And so how can that be slowed in order to keep from losing all the best healthcare professionals from Nigeria? And I know that's your point. So I know, and it's complicated, but I observe that in the U.S. and I feel a lot of grief over the injustice, global injustice, even though it's personally satisfying for the individual to have a chance to have a better environment with more pay. But on the global level, it does seem like an injustice. I guess it's more of a comment, but I don't know if you have any reaction there.
And this isn't my area of expertise, but I tell you, I went through the databases and maybe half the articles are on medical profession, brain drain in Africa. Specifically. So it's a really serious issue. And that's where it seems almost most of the thinking is going into. So I had to find other articles to talk about education. So, and again, it's complex. Like imagine the research money you get, you know, coming to Johns Hopkins or something, as opposed to what you'd get in Zimbabwe or whatever, right? It's, there's no comparison. I don't judge anybody, but I do want to talk about the trends.
Well, with that, let's give Dr. Sherman a round of applause for his time and his input.